from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Two competing draft proposals will be on the table in Brussels as Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras prepares to sit down with the country's creditors. Greece's creditors have drafted broad lines of a deal with Athens in a bid to end 4 months of talks, but Greece's Syriza government has drafted a proposal of its own. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
Tsipras has pledged not to surrender to more austerity. He also said Athens has submitted a plan to its international creditors in an attempt to secure a deal over its debts.
We are not waiting for them to submit a proposal. In accordance with the Eurogroup's decision, Greece is submitting a plan. We have made concessions because a compromise requires concessions. We know these concessions will be difficult, but we have submitted a realistic proposal for Greece's exit from the crisis. A realistic plan whose acceptance by the institutions, the creditors, and our partners in Europe would mark the end of the scenarios of the division of Europe.
His statement follows talks in Berlin between the heads of the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank. Reports suggest that the meeting was aimed at coming up with a, quote, final proposal for Athens. Tsipras, who was in attendance at the meeting, said he had not yet been contacted by the IMF and European officials. The talks are aimed at unlocking $8 billion in bailout funds. Time's running out for Greece, with a Friday deadline looming for Athens to repay its $328 million debt to the International Monetary Fund. Let's talk to Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos, our correspondent in Athens. Konstantin, the Friday deadline is looming, and what can we expect from Greece?
Hassan, well, we've had the late-night sudden decision by the Greek Prime Minister. Alexis Tsipras will be travelling to Brussels for a personal meeting with Chief of European Commission Jean-Claude Juncker. He will be carrying, of course, this 47-page Greek proposal, the final draft, as they have received it already. But this will be in the Greek Premier's briefcase tomorrow evening for this highly crucial neuralgic, I would say, meeting with the European Commission chief. Now, of course, there is no doubt, Hassan, that Greece is facing a take-it-or-leave-it ultimatum. We keep hearing very bizarre things, like, for example, 28th of June and 5th of July have already been, discussed as dates for possible snap elections. But Syriza is not keen to go down without a fight. We have this meeting coming up tomorrow, and of course Greece looks highly unlikely to be able to make any payments this month to the IMF, or next month indeed to the ECB. At least 5 billion euros it has to scrape from somewhere if it really wants to keep up making loan repayments. This does not look a possible eventuality. We know, however, that the Greek Prime Minister tomorrow evening and for the rest of the week will be trying to hammer perhaps a temporary deal, maybe a three-month extension of the current agreement, same as they did back in February the 20th with that now infamous Eurogroup meeting. I think the Greek government, Hassan, will be trying to gain as much time as possible until the Spanish elections in autumn, late September, we think they will be held. And that will be quite a different story. If Syriza can stay in power until September, then the Podemos will most likely be winning the Spanish elections. And then, of course, two countries that are seeing eye to eye as far as anti-austerity is concerned will be able to then exert far greater pressure and may then be able to alter mainstream economic policy at the core. But at the moment, alone as it is, the Greek government in the European Union will be trying perhaps to hammer out a deal for the rest of the week. It looks unlikely. The feedback we're getting from Brussels and Frankfurt and from France, it is highly unlikely. But Tsipras will try to do something tomorrow evening with Jean-Claude Juncker. And of course, we are waiting to see this final draft, this final text that the creditors will be presenting the Greek government tomorrow, and see reactions and how they will be playing out in Greece and abroad for the rest of the week.
That meeting was set to take place in Brussels Wednesday evening. We'll have more on it tomorrow. From East Ukraine, Both sides in the civil war that's been ongoing for a year now have announced major breaches of the Minsk II accords that had brought relative quiet to the region. There have been numerous eyewitness and video reports of repeated shellings of cities and towns in the east by U.S.-backed forces of the regular Ukrainian army and irregular U.S.-trained right-wing militias, with mounting civilian casualties over the past weeks, and allegations from Kiev of truce ceasefire violations by self-defense forces in Donetsk and elsewhere in the region that now calls itself Novorus or New Russia. Wednesday saw a deep intensification of fighting across the front separating the two sides, with reports Wednesday that Novorus forces had taken the city of Maryinka and were rapidly advancing on Krasnogorovka and Korakova. According to unconfirmed reports from Donetsk, one of Ukraine's columns attempting to reinforce their troops in Maryinka had been hit by Novorus artillery, destroying 20 vehicles. Eric Dreitzer is a political analyst and the editor of StopImperialism.org. We spoke with him by telephone Wednesday.
Well, the reports coming out of East Ukraine are certainly troubling, and I think that they point to an escalation in this ongoing war, an escalation that is really being perpetrated primarily by the Kiev regime and its patrons in Washington and in the West, because, of course, the Minsk II agreements, which were reached a few months ago and called for the withdrawal of heavy artillery, were designed not only to create a sense of calm and a sense of stability, but also to de-escalate the conflict. And what we've actually seen in recent weeks and in recent days has been an escalation of the conflict precisely using heavy artillery. And this is an important point because the regime forces, that is to say the Kiev, the Ukrainian military, as well as the irregular paramilitaries, the Nazi battalions and others, they have been using heavy artillery and shelling civilian targets. And this is a critical point because what is happening is a blatant war crime, that is collective punishment of the people of Donbass, perpetration of collective punishment in the form of indiscriminate shelling of various cities, Donetsk city center and various outlying suburbs and towns. You've seen this happening repeatedly, and what the Ukrainian government has attempted to do is to create an equivalence between any attacks perpetrated against Kiev's military and those that Kiev's military actually carries out. And this is an utterly false equivalence, because on the one hand, the attacks by the Ukrainian military forces are against civilian targets, whereas the attacks carried out by the rebel forces are against military targets. They are not shelling civilian targets on the other side of the front lines. And this is a point that is utterly and completely suppressed in the Western narrative. They do not want to discuss the fact that there is this false equivalence happening, that one side is fighting against military forces and that the other side is fighting against civilian targets. And this is a critical aspect of all of this because this points to the broader issue of not only the escalation of this war, but the very nature of it, that the regime in Kiev is fighting a war against the people of Donbass, the very people who live there, not simply the rebels or the so-called quote-unquote pro-Russian separatists. They are fighting a war of ethnic cleansing. They are fighting a war that to a large extent is a war of extermination, or at the very least a war of intimidation and indiscriminate violence. And that is precisely what's been happening in the east of Ukraine. And so you have OSCE monitors on the ground who refuse to tell the full story of what is happening. They refuse to give a full accounting of all of these violations. And instead, you have the talking points that are parroted by the State Department, that is the U.S. State Department, as well as by outlets throughout the West, who basically say that the quote-unquote, the overwhelming majority of violations are carried out by the rebels of the East, which is absolute nonsense, and it goes against the facts on the ground, which are clearly and unmistakably documented. And this is, again, absolutely essential for people to understand that the nature of this war is not what they make it out to be in the Western media. This, from the perspective of the people of Donbass, this is a war for their very existence. This is a war to protect their homes, their families, their towns. This is a war to save their infrastructure, the very fabric of their society. On the other hand, from Kiev's perspective, this is a war to make them submit, a war of subjugation, a war of extermination. if you will. And I think that that point is absolutely essential. And then it should also be noted that recent days and recent weeks have seen various forms of escalation carried out by Kiev. And I think one of the major ones, one of the principal ones, and this is a provocation of the highest order, is the appointment of former Georgian President Saakashvili to be the governor of Odessa. Because what Saakashvili's claim to fame is, of course, starting a war with Russia in South Ossetia and Abkhazia in 2008, when he ordered the shelling of Russian peacekeepers and Russian speakers in that region. And the fact that he has that experience, the fact that he's connected to the neocon networks, connected to the Iraq War cabal and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all of these characters, the fact that he has all of these connections makes him the perfect candidate to execute the U.S. Geopolitical agenda in the south of Ukraine now, because what they're looking to do is to essentially open up a new front in the war in Ukraine. This is a new front on the side of Transnistria, another region that has been restive in recent months, another region that is definitely worried that the war that Ukraine has been waging against Donbass is going to come to their region as well, as they have many of the same grievances when it comes to the Nazi putsch regime in Kiev. And so the fact that Saakashvili, a non-Ukrainian, has been appointed by the puppet government backed by the U.S., to carry out their agenda, I think, is a signal of very, very dark developments in Ukraine, very, very troubling development of this conflict, because if you have a multi-front war, you're looking at essentially the disintegration of the entire nation as it has existed, and that means free rein for the Azov Battalion, free rein for the Nazi militias, free rein for the extremists and the thugs to carry out brutal intimidation. And this intimidation and political repression has been happening now really since the beginning of the conflict. I'm one of the, I think, few people writing in the English language who has documented very serious political repression in the city of Odessa, which is now governed by Saakashvili. You have hundreds of political prisoners sitting in prison without trial, without charges, or on trumped-up charges. Independent media outlets that have been critical of the Kiev regime have been shut down. They've been physically assaulted, intimidated, kidnapped, disappeared. You have many indigenous grassroots groups who have sprung up, such as the People's Rada of Bessarabia, which is an attempt to essentially protect the cultural and ethnic sovereignty of the multicultural region of Odessa, which is historically a multilingual, multi-ethnic, multinational part of Ukraine. All of these groups have been under assault by Kiev. And so what you're actually seeing from the broadest perspective then is that the U.S.-backed puppet government is essentially trying to execute its will on various parts of Ukraine for the purposes of carrying out the U.S. agenda. And the U.S. agenda is quite clear: to suck Russia into a direct military intervention into Ukraine. Poroshenko knows that his government simply cannot win militarily in Donbass. And so his backers in Washington, his puppet masters, have essentially ordered him, or at least implied to him, that what he needs to do is he needs to escalate and expand the war in order to force Russia's hand, in order to force a direct intervention, thereby making Russia into the aggressor. This is the scale of the political gambit that Washington is putting forward, and this is unbelievably dangerous. The danger level has probably never been higher than it is right now, and of course that is also never discussed in the Western media narrative, because if it were discussed, people in the West might actually have an opinion about it.
In Yemen, the Yemeni army, including fighters with the Yemeni Popular Committees and Ansar ruler forces, shelled the Saudi military's communication networks at the Mazhaf military site in Saudi Arabia's Jizan region. According to the Yemeni Al-Misra TV network, the Yemenis targeted several other Saudi military bases and camps on Wednesday. More than 30 rockets from Yemen also struck Saudi military positions at Zahran South in the Asir border region. Those developments came on the same day that fresh Saudi aerial raids in northwestern Yemen killed at least 6 people, and as Saudi warplanes intensified their airstrikes on Yemen's capital of Sana'a. Saudi Arabia began the aerial campaign against Yemen on March 26th without a UN mandate. Fighting has thus far claimed the lives of approximately 2,000 people, according to the UN. Members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, are meeting in Vienna to discuss oil production levels for the second half of this year. Iran's oil minister, Bijan Namdar Zanganeh, said that the OPEC members can decide whether to keep current output levels or increase them based only on consensus.
It's very clear that we have oversupply in the market, and this oversupply put pressure on the price, and during the last month we witnessed a sharp decline in oil price in the global market. And now it's our responsibility to review this situation and to decide appropriate decision for balancing the market. But it depends on the consensus between all OPEC members.
Press TV's Oma Leski was in Vienna Wednesday for the meeting. She spoke with Bardi Ahonadar after the meeting broke.
Exactly. Now, 6 months ago, Bardia, when OPEC met here in Vienna, the Austrian capital, the decision was made, and that decision was mainly led by Saudi Arabia, which is called by some the de facto leader because of the influence it has on the Arab members of the OPEC organization, that production levels would not be cut. In fact, they would increase. And this has, of course, led to a drop in prices. And this was something that Iran was basically against. At the time when we were speaking to the Iranian oil minister, he was saying that this is not a good move when it comes to oil prices. And a lot of analysts have also said that it comes at the cost of the poorer members of OPEC, for instance, like Iraq or Venezuela, who don't have enough foreign exchange reserves to make up for the low prices. I was speaking to Mr. Badri here, the Secretary General of OPEC, and asking him this question. He said there have been complaints actually about this, but he believes that the market can balance itself. And Saudi Arabian oil minister, when he arrived in Vienna for the sixth international seminar of OPEC, just ahead of the main OPEC meeting where the decision will be made, he also said that he believes the market is moving in the right direction and that, in fact, high-cost supply has dropped and demand is rising. The argument that is put by those who support the Saudi initiative is basically that there's going to be an increase in demand, but Iran maintains, along with its supporters basically in OPEC, that this is not going to be beneficial. What basically Saudi Arabia is saying, it wants to maintain OPEC's share in the market, especially when it comes to competition with the US shale oil companies. But I'd just like to add here that an important comment that was made by the oil minister here at the seminar just half an hour ago, when he said that once sanctions on Iran are lifted, if a possible, of course, nuclear deal is reached between Iran and the P5+1, that is going to significantly affect Iran's output and Iran's share, market share in OPEC, because he said that immediately after sanctions are lifted following a deal, Iran will increase its production by 500,000, and then in 6 or 7 months it will increase it to 1 million barrels per day. And that would, of course, again maybe create rifts within OPEC, which will also be discussed. But these are the most important aspects that we heard today in the seminar. The decision to be made by OPEC, whether they're going to keep this production level, will be made on Friday, and the analysts agree that most probably OPEC will decide to maintain the status quo.
Iran is one of a group of OPEC members that wants a decrease in oil production to support prices, which have lost almost half of their value in the past 12 months. While the U.S. rushes to negotiate the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, or TPP, outside of the view of the public and on a fast track, another treaty being pushed by the U.S. was being publicly vetted by members of the European Parliament in New York City. Tuesday saw a discussion at the U.N. of the so-called TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, also called simply the TTP. Tiziana Beguin is a member of the European Parliament with the Europe of Freedom and Direct Democracy group. That group is made up of Eurosceptic parties of various political orientation, ranging from the right-wing UKIP in Britain to her own party's direct democracy model. She was one of the presenters at the meeting Tuesday.
We, as a member of the European Parliament, represent the democratic scrutiny over the Commission, and similarly to the US Senate, we are called to approve every international trade agreement by a vote. In our case, it is a simply majority one. As you can see, the way Europe works in international agreements compares to those of any other federal system. This makes my work as a member of the International Trade Committee very relevant to the interests of my country and citizens. As an Italian member of the European Parliament, I am concerned with the consequence of TTIP and other major trade agreement for Europe and Italy, and I cannot accept the corporate interests and the removal of safety and environmental standard is hidden behind a legitimate claim for more and better international trade. As a matter of fact, this is what TTIP is about. We often hear that it will create jobs and growth both in Europe and the US. But when we look at previous experience, the pictures look scary. 20 years ago, NAFTA was put forward as the deal of the century for the US. But now it is acknowledged that it has done little to create new American jobs and that it has worked the opposite way. This is what we fear about TTIP in Europe, and I spend every day, I'm not in Parliament, informing citizens about it. I'm honored to be here today, and I would like to focus my intervention to this conference on a broader matter, that is the economic and social impact of a transatlantic deal, not just for Europe, but for the entire world. Indeed, I believe that a deep and comprehensive free trade area between the two most developed economic blocs in the world is a matter that it is far from being a business for two. If a TTIP will be agreed, its repercussion will be felt long after its approval and it will have an impact on the international balance of power as we know it. I believe one of the main reasons behind TTIP to be geopolitical. China has risen considerably in the last decades, and it is challenging the Western predominance. In this respect, the idea of tightening the economic ties across the Atlantic in response to an external stimulus is not new. A similar idea was proposed in the 1960s by the US to back up economically the military power of NATO and trying to oppose the Soviet Union. Today's initiatives look similar to the 60s, but the international context has deeply changed. The picture today looks gloomy for the Western powers, no matter what index is used. The developing world would overtake the West by 2030. Whether this is to be looked at with concern or not is open to debate. In my view, it depends on whether we believe modern powers should, economically speaking, converge or compete. And this is particularly important vis-à-vis a country like China. While Brussels and Washington seem to speak the language of convergence, what they really want to do is creating an economic bloc that will compete with the rising power of the BRICS. This TTIP risks to become, as Mrs. Clinton once put it, in economic NATO. And indeed, to quote an interesting study by Kleinschendel Institute of the Netherlands, TTIP is not about free trade. It brings together countries and societies that are willing to defend their ways of life against rising competitive powers. Personally, I believe that we should not see the world in such conflicting terms. But I think my views are not shared by the political elites of both Europe and US. Indeed, the US and partly the EU are scared by the idea of losing ground to China. Before the economic crisis that numbers shrank, the US was the main trade partner for 127 countries, but that number shrank to 70 due to the crisis, while China has become the main trade partner for 124 countries. And soon, it could make the yuan one of the main currencies for international exchange. In this sense, TTIP would buy the West the resource it must need, time. As a matter of fact, it is found that Chinese economy is negatively affected when TTIP is realized, and the decrease in Chinese GDP could be up to 0.7%. When both TTIP and TPP are realized and China is excluded, the combined damage in Chinese economy is higher than the damage of TTIP alone, and the decrease in Chinese GDP could go up to 2.3%. Furthermore, the US wants to reinforce its partnership with Europe, with a wide and comprehensive free trade area to act like a counterweight to the economic cooperation between China and Russia, which saw a major breakthrough with the agreement between Gazprom and the CNCP, the Chinese National Petroleum Company, for the supply of $400 billion of Russian gas to China in 30 years. This agreement will completely change the balance of power in Asia, because Russia has shown to Europe that it has an alternative market for its energy, while China reduced its dependency on U.S. coal. This is the international context in which TTIP is born, and the same is true for TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which can be read as being a treaty open to everybody but China. Having this context in mind, one would believe that we are going to live in a world of regional powers competing to each other. But this is unclear, and we cannot possibly tell now. What is clear, on the contrary, is that this risk to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. We don't know if the international relation for the next 50 years will be shaped by such strong opposition, but if we actually go down the path of TTIP and TPP, we are deliberately choosing to support this idea of the future. The idea that the world will leave to the next generation will be based on competition instead of convergence. The main downside of TTIP could be indeed to widen the political gap within the West and the East. Now, all these considerations belong to the realm of possibilities. But if you allow me a slight change of topic, what is certain is that TTIP is a bilateral deal and that it will have huge consequences on the multilateral system created with GATT and the WTO. This will be detrimental, first of all, to poor countries. Between the 90s and 2000s, the world chose the path of multilateralism. Multilateralism is indeed much more complicated to achieve, but it involves a radical change in trade relations when it succeeds. The European Union is committed by treaty to the promotion of multilateralism. But by tying the two biggest economies by a bilateral trade agreement, we exclude developing countries and emerging powers from the negotiations. When I asked to the negotiators to what extent this deal could be harmful to the multilateral trade system, they told me that TTIP could be converted into a multilateral agreement with countries that they may wish to participate. Now, neither Washington nor Brussels have devised a strategy for the at least indirect involvement of developing countries in the negotiations, and the risk is that it will never be possible. Bilateral deal could never be extended to become a truly multilateral one. Without even going as far as predicting the impossible inclusion of new partners in TTIP, a transatlantic deal will be damaging for developing countries in many ways, starting from the removal of tariffs that will put goods from American countries entering the EU duty-free on the same footing with US goods. One study by Bertelsmann Stiftung predicts huge market losses for countries like Tanzania, Uganda, Ivory Coast, and many others. How this will affect the stability of these countries is yet to be seen.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.